Well, so thank you to Ken Maley for the selection of the passage this morning. I've put it out there and I'll say again, I'm happy to talk on whatever passage you pick. It's a risky thing to say, but that's what we've got this morning. So if anyone else has something you're burning to hear me have a go at, go for it. I'm sort of working through Luke, but pick it from anywhere, that's fine. We'll have a crack. So this is often described in the commentaries as the hardest parable in the collection. I don't think we'll have too many arguments about that. I'll give you a spoiler at the start. I'm going to call it as a parable of grace. So here we go. First, let's talk about what actually happens in this parable. At the start, you have a manager. He's the... Sorry, I'm breathless. I'll take a deep breath. Trying to manage that half of the room at the same time. He's the oikonomos. He's the oikos is the house, the estate, the financial dealings. It's not just a domestic role. To be in charge of that is to be the chief manager of a large financial estate. And he's accused of mismanaging. He's accused of wastefulness is actually the word that's used. It's very interesting. It's the same word that's used when the prodigal son's described as going to a far country and wasting his inheritance. This is the same word that's used. He's accused of wastefulness. There's no evidence that he's guilty of it necessarily. He doesn't fight the charge. It just says he's accused of it, and on the basis of the accusation, his master decides to sack him. Now, he has no hope of a future. To fire this man essentially is to cast him into abject poverty and potentially to death, because he's a white-collar worker, and nobody else is going to employ him if he's got a reputation as being a dishonest manager. And as he says in his own monologue, you hear his thoughts, well, can I dig? I'm not strong enough. Can I beg? I'm too ashamed. What'll I do? And as I was reading this, it brought to mind stories of the Depression and of office clerks from Perth, unemployed, up in the hills in Mundaring, trying to fell Jarrah. Alongside hardened forestry workers who knew how to fell Jarrah, and they couldn't meet their quotas, they couldn't meet ends meet. This is the thing he's looking at. I'm an office clerk and I've got to go out and fell Jarrah. I cannot dig, I'm not strong enough. I can't compete with those who that's what they do. So he thinks, I've got to look after my future. And he draws on the Mediterranean cultural assumption of reciprocity. If I look after you, you will look after me. It's not just a nice thing that might happen. It's a very strong cultural basis of how the society is organised. The debts, the size of which he is able to amend, means he's dealing with wealthy people. The amount that he reduces those debts is about 3 years' wages. So we're talking about very large sums. So the people who can owe that much money are likely to be people of substance, which is a good choice if you're trying to find someone who's obliged culturally to reciprocate. There's some discussion about whether he's reducing it by his commission, whether he had a commission on top of the actual debt or some sort of interest, and that's what he's taken off, so that the master actually gets the same and he loses his bit. Although he doesn't actually lose anything, because if he's been fired, he can't get his commission either, so he's reducing it by money that nobody was going to get. Possibly. There's not a whole lot of evidence, unfortunately, for that, because it would solve things very nicely. It's possible, and the commentators in the 1970s and 80s thought that was a great idea, but more recently scholarship has said we really don't have much to base that on. There's also the notion that it's illegal for the Jews to charge interest. The usury is illegal, and if he's charging interest, then the claim that he's a dishonest manager could be because he's dishonestly marking up the debts. Although the claim actually at the start is that he's being wasteful, so that's not quite, doesn't quite fit. So it's possible that what he's actually doing is not illegal, but he's playing with his margin. It's possible that what he's doing is just plain illegal, that he's been fired, and very quickly, and the passage says, quick, a few times, quick, rewrite your debt. Very quickly, before anyone knows that he's fired, he goes out and marks down a bunch of debts. So he continues to present himself as being the legitimate manager of the estate, who in that role would have permission to act entirely on his master's behalf, to be the master in financial dealings, except that he's been fired, so he actually doesn't anymore. So he would have the authority in that role to mark up and mark down, because he's responsible for getting a return. And I mean, Tony can probably tell me this, if you've got someone in the yard and I can sell you this, well, what if I mark it down $3,000, then you can have it. You don't have to go and check with the boss every time. You've got a sense of, I've got the responsibility for being able to deal here when you're employed in the role. Once you're fired, you don't. So he presents himself as still having that authority, as acting in place of the master. And the fact that he gets them to write their debts quickly, there's a sense that he's acting very quickly before he gets caught, before the fraud is shown and nobody will deal with him anymore. Ironically, in doing this, he wins a great deal of prestige and honour for the master. Because in a society where saving face is very important, he's acting in behalf of the master and making the master look very generous. Now, the master's a bit caught then, because once he finds out, it'd be very difficult for him to go back to those debtors and say, actually, I've been swindled and I'd actually like the full debt. It just would culturally not be appropriate to do that. So what he'll have to wear it, but in response, people think he's much more generous than he really is. So the manager's been very shrewd by tricking the master into accepting the fraud by putting him in a social situation where he can't then say, I'll have that back. Now, it's possible that that all goes swimmingly, or it's also possible that everyone knows that he's made the master look really foolish and that everyone can see that this cunning deceit's gone on and all his merchant friends have a quiet laugh behind their hand. My sister used to work in customs, and when she was being trained as a customs officer, they talked about the three emotions that drug traffickers are likely to feel coming through customs: fear, guilt, and the most beautifully named, duping delight, which is the emotion of joy you get when you realise you've tricked someone. It's officially named by customs, duping delight. The sense of having pulled off a swindle. And I think that's what the steward is a feeling here. Possibly some fear and guilt, but there's a great deal of duping delight. And then the steward, the manager, is praised. And that's at the point at which we all start scratching our heads. The reason he's praised, it says the unjust steward is praised. So there's no question that someone's not noticed that he's done the wrong thing. So the word that's used is the word that's for justice or righteousness, unjust or unrighteous. The unrighteous steward is praised for his phronimos, which is to do with being sensible, wise, shrewd, prudent, thoughtful. The headings will translate this as the crafty or cunning steward, but I don't think the word's got those sort of sneaky overtones. It's just he's praised for being astute. So that's quite a story. And then there follows some interpretive bits, which are there's four, and they sort of expand out from being quite specific to getting broader in application. So the first one is, be as astute as those as people of the world. People of the light, be as astute as people of the world. Using imagery. The second one is to do with using money for eternal outcomes. So it stretches a bit further and says, use your wealth to shore up your eternal future. probably to do with serving the poor, but we'll talk about that in a minute. The third one, a bit broader, is about, well, if you can't be trusted in small things, you can't be trusted in large things. If you can't be trusted with your own, with someone else's things, you'll never be given your own. And the fourth one, the great maxim of it all, well, you can't serve God and money. You've got to choose. So that's sort of the interpretive pieces at the bottom. Now, when I speak to this group, I sort of assume that you have an understanding, as I do, that the pieces of the Bible were not written by someone sitting down one day and thinking, I'll write the whole lot, I'll tell you everything I know about Jesus, and just, you know, in the beginning through to the resurrection and the ascension. That Luke, or the person writing Luke, gathered up the stories he knew, the pieces, other documents, pulled it together, and for the purpose of his own community, he pulled it into a document to pass on. So it's a composition of lots of bits and pieces pulled together by a very thoughtful editor. And I think these four applications of the parable are appendages to an original story that were not originally part of the story. Now, whether they were wisdom sayings of Jesus that he said at other times, or whether in even his own retelling of the story, I'm sure he told his stories more than once, he sometimes had those bits on the end and sometimes didn't. You know, one commentator that I found really useful talked about this as the notes from four different sermons on the parable left behind on the end of it. Now, a lot of commentators have this idea of digging back to what Jesus really said, and then you don't have to take the rest of it very seriously. And I find that hard. I don't think that's fair. I think we need to respect Luke as a very wise theologian and a pastor to his people who thought that all of this was needed. I'm left wondering if maybe Luke was able to hold together more than one meaning. Maybe use a grace parable as a segue into pieces about money, rather than having it to mean always one or always the other. Maybe he'd heard it used in different contexts and settings, and he knew it needed to be in there, but needed to have enough space that it could be read in different ways. So, what could it mean then? Now, sitting on the edge of the bench over there is an enormous fat book on the parables, where I've bookmarked two pages that have about a four-line paragraph outlining maybe 15 different meanings of what people have interpreted this parable to mean. So if you're interested in sitting over there and have a skim through, it's quite diverse. Sort of the first school of what does this mean is that this is a parable about money, as the appended wisdom saying sermon notes sort of lead in that direction, and particularly that it's about using your money for those less fortunate, which might seem a leap, so we'll work with that. The idea being that if you need to use, it's that verse 9, use your money for eternal ends, it's to shore up friends for when your money runs out, that piece. How could you possibly use your money that would have any impact on eternity is the question that it obviously raises, because it doesn't seem right. It just doesn't seem to fit. And the thought that's put forward then is, well, who are the... If you get to the pearly gates... Hold some imagery with me. If you get to the pearly gates and God says to you, you know, God has someone to ask on your behalf, who would be God's advisors? Well, the poor, clearly, would be the ones God would ask to say, how about Thelma? How did she go? Sorry, Thelma, first from the left. And so you better, in your life, use your money so that when you get to heaven, the poor will say, oh, Thelma, she was pretty good. Yeah, she gave us some money. So that's one of the interpretations. If this is a parable about how you use your money, that's the interpretation of what it's saying to you about how you use your money. And part of the bit we didn't continue reading, because is a set of sayings that seem quite random. They really seem to be thrown in there just because Luke ran out of things to say and put them in one chunk. But There's a general theme through this chapter leading up to the parable of Lazarus and the rich man is the second half of the chapter. So Luke's clearly heading in a direction. He's got a theme about using money and using wealth going at this point. So this, if this parable is about money, then it's leading into that section and it's part of a... And the story of Lazarus seems to go with this idea that what Abraham did with his wealth in his life had an effect on the eternal outcome. One of the commenters called this parable a call to financial stewardship, and that we in the church should be talking to each other about how we use our money and how we use our money for what he called kingdom economics. Now, I'm giving you a few options because, frankly, I don't think there's a solid conclusion as to what this means. This is not the one I hold with, but I've said before, there are multiple valid readings of a lot of this, and this is a very strongly held reading by lots of people. The second reading is that it's not about money per se, but about attitude. That there's a coming crisis and we need to be alert and astute in how we respond. And that Jesus has been here at the time that they're talking about. He's here on earth talking about we cannot go on as we are. We need change. An astute assessment of the situation and a decisive change of direction is needed. So it's sort of saying keep on your toes or you'll be outfoxed by the people who've got no interest in the kingdom. Or sort of extending from that, is this a parable about eternity and about being careful that you get there? The coming crisis then is eternal judgment, so you need to be ready. And that's where it comes in about to be ready for eternal judgment, you better make friends with the poor. Talks about the children of the light and the dark, but we are all the children of the light and of the dark. So it's not necessarily saying you people here compare with those people out there who are very clever with their money and you better be just as clever in how you deal with spiritual matters. It could also be saying look at yourself and how very thoughtful and planned you are about looking after your earthly future. How careful you are with your money, how shrewd you are with your choices about the financial matters of your life. What if you applied that sort of dedication to the matters of your soul? I think that is a useful question. I don't think it's necessarily the strongest question of this parable, but I think it's a useful question to think about. My problem with all those interpretations is that it's a very detached sense of God. Counting up good and bad deeds and measuring our performance, which doesn't seem to match with the rest of Luke or the Gospel or even the Bible more broadly. If we're choosing these readings, we need to wrestle with that tension. And I think that's why it jars us when Lee read it and we went, ooh. I think it's partly to do with that jarring of it doesn't seem to sit right with other depictions of Jesus. It seems a contradiction. We also need to deal with the way that the appended sayings of the parable, which lead into these interpretations, don't actually seem to be saying quite the same thing as the parable itself. Now, this is written as a story about how people deal with money. Now, if this were a story about bushwalking or cooking, I think we'd find it easier to see it as a metaphor. If Jesus had told a story about cooking, it's very unlikely that we then read it and go, well, we must always make sure the garlic goes in before the sage. Because we would understand that he's using imagery. But when it's money, we don't joke about that. So when he's using money, we can't hold it lightly. We find that very hard. It's so close to our hearts. I'm going to ask you to hold it lightly and work with it as a metaphor, as an image, rather than as a story about money. The first thing I notice then is this is a situation where everyone wins. The manager obviously gains a secure future and friends who will provide for him, so he wins. The master gains a reputation for generosity, which in a society based very strongly on reputation is really, really important. And the debtors have their debts reduced, possibly even to a level they could pay. which would free them from this servitude of debt. So is this showing us a God who delights in win-win situations? The only thing that loses out is the letter of the law in this parable. God is delighting in the win-win, even if the rules are bent to get there. Praising a creative solution where no one loses except that tick-the-box law-keeping. Working sort of in the same direction. Others have suggested that this is a parable that's a biography of Jesus, about the rogue nature of grace and of Jesus' ministry. That it's part of the previous chapter 15 that leads into it. Now, chapter 15, which of course you all know off by heart, begins, it's Jesus defending who he associates with. And then it's a continuation with the discourse of the lost sheep and coin and son. Bye. Thank you for coming. Sorry. It's all right. They're my friends and I know it's okay. So I'm going to read it to you in this context. I want you to listen to it, how it reads if we read it as the end of that rather than the start of the passage about money. So chapter 15 starts with, "The tax collectors and sinners, however, were all crowding round to listen to him, and the Pharisees and scribes complained, saying, 'This man welcomes sinners and eats with them.' So he told them this parable, the one about the lost sheep, then the one about the lost coin, and then the one about the lost son, the prodigal." Prodigal. I'll pick it up from towards the end of the prodigal. "Now the elder son was out in the fields on his way back, and as he drew near the house, he could hear music and dancing. Calling one of the servants, he asked what it was all about. The servant told him, 'Your brother's come, and your father's killed the calf we'd been fattening, because he's got him back safe and sound.' He was angry then and refused to go in, and his father came out and began to urge him to come in, but he retorted to his father, 'All these years I've slaved for you and never once disobeyed any of your orders, yet you've never offered me so much as a kid for me to celebrate with my friends. But for this son of yours, when he comes back after swallowing up your property, he and his loose women, you kill the calf we'd been fattening.' The father said, 'My son, you're with me always, and all I have is yours, but it was only right that we should celebrate and rejoice, because your brother here was dead and has come to life. He was lost and is found.' He also said to his disciples, 'There was a rich man, and he had a steward who was denounced to him for being wasteful with his property. He called for the man and said, "What's this I hear about you? Draw me up an account of your stewardship, because you're not to be my steward any longer." Then the steward said to himself, 'Now that my master's taking the stewardship from me, what am I to do? Dig? Not strong enough. Go begging? I'd be too ashamed. Oh, I know what I'll do. To make sure that when I'm dismissed from office, there will be someone to welcome me into their homes.' Then he called his master's debtors one by one. To the first he said, 'How much do you owe the master?' 100 measures of oil, he said. The steward said, 'Here, take your bond. Sit down and quickly write 50. To another he said, "And sir, how much do you owe?" 100 measures of wheat. The steward said, "Here, take your bond and write 80. And the master praised the dishonest steward because of his astuteness. Reads differently that way, doesn't it? I think he's turning to the older brother. I identify strongly with the older brother. That's who I can see myself in most. And he says to the older brother, the older brother says, "It's not fair." My sister tells me I spent my whole childhood saying, "It's not fair." She said, "It's no surprise you grew up to be interested in justice, because it's all you did all your childhood." I said, "It's not fair." And it's as if in response, the father or Luke on behalf says, "Well, let me tell you about how not fair it is. But that's how we roll around here." Or maybe he says, "Well, what would you have me do? Cast your brother out? Let's see how that might work out if I cast him out at this point. It would be like a master firing his manager. He would find a way to get back on his feet, because otherwise he'd die and he'd probably use your money. And look how cleverly he manages it. Oh, the lovable scoundrel. What a rascal. Oh, I love him. Perhaps you could loosen up a bit and just have a laugh about it with me. So the steward here is a Christ figure. The steward, the manager. He's going rogue with God's message, wasting it on outcasts. He has no authorization to cancel those debts. Have we heard that accusation against Jesus? Maybe God's pleased to get his friends back rather than have those debts in full. Perhaps the debtors wouldn't deal with an honest manager, but they could work with a scoundrel. And Jesus can reach them when he lets go of the holy righteous thing. Robert Farah Capon, my favourite commentator on the parables, says, "We should be grateful that we do not have to deal with a just steward." And possibly as another layer, or alternately, maybe this is talking about how we are stewards of God's goodness. Are we being tight-fisted with the things of God, or are we being generous? Because it's not the manager's money. He's dealing with someone else's riches. He doesn't try to prove his right or wrong standing. Maybe if we stop trying to prove our right or wrong standing with God and just get on with using God's goodness to restore relationship with others, to free them of their debts. The rich man seems quite disinterested in whether he gets his debts back at the end. At the start, he fires the guy because of it. So he's rich. He has the capacity to absorb the loss. How much more has God got the capacity to absorb the loss? Are we using God's wealth for what it was intended, to release debtors? It's that wonderful word, aphesis, release, forgiveness, which I've talked about before as being so central to Luke's theology and the mission of Jesus. The use of the language of debt is a clue in Luke that we're not just talking about money, because it's the language of the Lord's Prayer, "Forgive us our debts as we forgive those." It's not talking about money. Like any reading of this parable, there's things you'll have to wrestle with, because none of the readings sit perfectly and easily. You'll need to consider, why in the parable are the debts reduced and not erased? My answer is because it's a story, it's an analogy, it's not a word-for-word exact depiction of the economy of God. You'll need to consider the tricky thing at the start about the steward, the Christ figure, maybe the disciples, being turfed out of the employ of God. My reading into that is the passage from Philippians about Christ emptying himself of the things of God and entering the incarnation. Does he leave heaven to go rogue? Or is this a how much more story? How much more? If this manager who was fired could be this, how much more would Jesus, who is the legitimate emissary of God, do this? And I think we need to take seriously the appended sermon note commentaries at the end, because clearly many people over many hundreds of years have thought this was a parable about money and about attitude and about eternity. What if I'm making God out to be more gracious than God really is? What if I am? Because I do it all the time, you might have noticed. I think this parable shows God laughing joyfully at that and accepting the reputation as a generous master rather than being interested in how much is lost in the transaction. What if everyone came to God expecting to be loved? Do you think God would say, "Oh, no, they've deceived you. I'm actually not as good as people told you"? Then God loses face, God loses out, God loses us. Can we change God's mind? Like Abraham sparing the city, like the Syrophoenician woman who, when Jesus tells her he's come only for the Jews, changes his mind and expands his vision to all. Can we change Jesus' mind? Maybe it's a stretch to say if I preach such grace of God that God would change God's mind, but could Jesus change God's mind? Make God look more gracious so that when we come to God, God will laugh and praise Jesus for bringing us in, however, and accept our Jesus-shaped assumptions that God is full of grace. I think God is laughing, sharing in the duping delight of pulling off the greatest swindle of all time. Jesus welcoming us rogues into the household of God, not just with our debts reduced, but released of them completely.
Thanks, Claire. That gives me a different perspective altogether. And it makes me think that maybe part of it is Jesus is having a shot at the Pharisees who tithed 10% of their herbs and counted how many steps you could walk on the Sabbath and all that sort of thing in an effort to say, I'm good enough in God's eyes, and criticised the people who didn't follow those rules. And Jesus made a point of breaking those rules, healing people on the Sabbath and doing all sorts of things and getting the ire of the Pharisees because he wasn't up to the mark. And that seems to fit in with what you're saying.
Yeah, and it's put the start of chapter 15, he's accused implicitly by the religious leaders of having the wrong company. And the verses we didn't go on to from 14 on, verse 14 says, well, the Pharisees were incensed because they loved money. So it picks that up very strongly. Yeah, Ken at the back.
Oh. Just a quick one, Claire. Did I hear you say the manager praised the steward for his actions?
Yes, absolutely.
Which passage is that from the Bible?
It's 16 verse 7. 7a. 7, 8a or 7. It's right at the end of the parable-y bit.
I don't have the Bible in front of me, but there's a sentence that's something like, make friends with money, so that when it's gone, ... The way I hear that as well is that making friends with money isn't so that you can accumulate it and wallow in it so much as make friends with it, i.e. don't have an angsty relationship with it because it's going to be gone anyway. Is there anything you can sort of draw from that or not?
If you take this parable to be about money, then there are certainly layers of that about having a detached attitude, I suppose, is a way of saying it, to your money. So, and certainly the leading towards you cannot serve God and money, ensure that money is your money is the tool that you use, not the master that you serve. And that's there in those explanatory minutes. It's verse 9, the piece you're talking about. John at the back.
Maybe a trivial point, but I'm surprised that the steward asks the debtor to mark it down. Why didn't the steward mark it?
The commentators seem to think that having it in the debtor's own handwriting is important, that the debt would be witnessed by the manager, but that it had to be, because it was a debt between the debtor and the master, if it was written in the manager's hand, it would be suspect, but if it was written in the debtor's hand, that it would have more authority.
Kind of following on from what Trish was saying, I think he was just trying to mess with their heads. Yeah, that's right. I think it is about money and isn't about money, but I think he was picking on a sacred cow, which then follows on from the attitudes of the Pharisees. I thought by getting this, my thoughts would form, but I don't think this is mainly about money. I think he's picked a sacred cow to mess with their heads and to be counter to the normal logic that this is serious. But the other thing that I was going to say is it's just a parable. Don't read too much into parables. Don't make theologies out of parables. That if he's messing with your head, it's the overall sense that you get from the parable of what the message is rather than the individual components, trying to read too much into them. Just a thought.
The parables can be compared to a joke where if you have to explain the joke, you've lost it. That it has a thing and a power in itself. Jesus used them in a particular way that others didn't use them, in that other people use stories like that to illustrate their point, whereas Jesus used them, it appears, just on their own to be the point, which was quite a radical and different way to use these stories to have them describe God, rather than saying God is loving and welcoming and whatever, to just picture language it and describe it as in that way was quite unique in how he taught. Eden's got a question.
I was just going to say that in our modern reading of it, at my first instinctual reaction is that this is just an awful, hard story. It's not a nice, easy parable. And my reaction against the master and all of them, you know, how dare they be fraudulent and nasty, and this is how not to act rather than how to act. I think that's... that's my sense of why we find this parable so hard to understand or to make any sense of, is that going on from what Paul said about that emotional reaction is so negative, rather than finding a way to make it positive. Is that a sense of why people find it hard?
Yeah, absolutely. And parables also characteristically upend the expected ending, which is like a joke. That a joke works because the way you think it's going to end, it comes in with a different plane and churns it. I don't want you to think, because I'm talking about this as a parable of grace, that I think Jesus wasn't interested in what you do with your money, because I think he was. And clearly, that some of the multi-layering is using this language, is raising the issue of money. I mean, saying you cannot serve both God and money is raising the idea of how you use your money to challenge the first commandment, the whether you hold an idol except God, any other gods except yourself, which was sacred ground for the Jewish audience. So he's very interested in what you do with your money, but I don't think this story is telling you what to do with it.